This is Keith Miller, and I'd like to talk to you about the miracle of intimacy. What I'd like to do in this time is to divide it into three basic areas. I'd like to talk about some questions which have come up since I wrote the book, Please Love Me, and some questions about the characters and about why I wrote the book. Then I'd like to deal with an anatomy of an intimate relationship. What is it that causes that ephemeral thing to happen, which is almost like magic? How do we maintain it, and what makes it deteriorate? And then lastly, I'd like to talk about the intimacy between a person and God. I think we've hidden these thoughts from ourselves, and this raises the first question. People have asked me, why did you write this book? And in line with that question, why does it seem to have such a disturbing effect on so many of those who read it? I don't know, of course, but I think that just my own deep feeling is that the search for intimacy is one of the major motivating themes of life, and it's so threatening and so scary to open oneself to another human being at any depth that we've repressed anything about this and pushed it off to the side and pushed it in our unconscious like a great beach ball underwater. And what's happened, I think, is that in dealing with Hetty Robinson's frantic struggle for intimacy with the opposite sex and with God, that many people have had their own feelings triggered, which have been pushed down all their lives. The second question is, why did you put yourself in the book as Art Parker? Why didn't you just say you were Keith Miller? Well, I thought about this, and I did it this way because it would have interrupted and blown the plot. People don't know Hetty Robinson because that's not her real name. And if they picked up the book, they might have known me. And the minute I came into the story after I'd spent 250 pages developing an interest in her life, suddenly they would have wanted to know why I was there and what I was doing. And I think it would have blocked her story in some way, or at least confused it. So I decided to come in as Art Parker. And then in order to be honest and do the thing the book talked about, I decided I'd have to reveal who I was and not to fake it with the reader. So that's why I did it. This question is this a book of recorded facts about a real woman named Hetty Robinson? And the answer to that is no, it's a book of feelings and responses based on those of a real woman whom I've called Hetty Robinson. As I said in the preface, some of the incidents and almost all the identities and locations have been changed and thus fictionalized, though based on Hetty's experiences. Another question is, what happened to Hetty and you as a result of writing the book? Well, Hetty, the woman on whose life the story is based, continues to have an exciting life. I don't feel free to talk about her and what happened to her on the inside because that's her part of this experience, and the book is not her life. It is about her life, so I can tell you more what happened to me. I can say, however, that I think the process of being totally honest as possible at least, and of examining your whole life and the conscious and unconscious motives for your behavior would be a very confronting and life-changing experience for anyone. It certainly was for me in this process because I did a lot of the same thing, and I believe it must have been for her. In my case, I saw how many unconscious games I play, and I began to try to face them. And I am amazed at how difficult it is because I've always thought of myself as being honest, and this was really kind of horrifying. Also, I saw how far I've gotten from the fresh intimacy with God I'd once had, and I made a new beginning with Him. And this has been hard, too, since I've been a professional in this field for a long time, to start all over again. I've been talking about the book and why I wrote it and what the responses have been and what happened to Hetty and me. There are a lot of other questions that have come up from this book. It's, in my experience, it's unique. There seems to be something about intimacy that is a haunting thing. And the questions, I got people to do anonymous questions who had read the book and give them to me so I could see what they were asking. And these may be some questions you've had about intimacy. One of the questions was, does intimacy mean the same thing as honesty? And I think not. I think I'll deal with that in talking about the anatomy of intimacy, but I think that's a common mistake, that people say, oh yeah, I was totally honest with them, I was intimate. And there's a quality of security that's missing in total honesty, a quality of attack. And if somebody's totally honest with me and wants me to be totally honest with them, without the security of caring, it just scares me to death, and I don't want to be. I recoil from that. Even though I say I'm going to be, maybe, just to tough it out with them, I don't want to be intimate with a person who demands total honesty. So I think one cannot demand honesty and call it intimacy. I think it is a mystery. Intimacy is something that two people enter into a situation in which it's like a flower opening. You can't open a flower. You can create conditions in which the flower can open. And I think that the aroma which comes to the people, and which is the heady part of this, is the thing which can't be captured. I'm going to describe how I think that takes place, but I don't think that honesty is equal to intimacy. Does everyone need the level of intimacy that you're talking about, this total kind of openness and vulnerability? Hedy obviously needed it, this question says, but many people seem to get along quite well without it. Well, I think when you say, does everyone need it, I think people follow what they need most, and I think people need security most. I think that having been blasted a few times, one is very reticent to be intimate again. And I think that people seem to get along without it, but people seem to get along without vitamins, without exercise, without a lot of things. They die early and they are miserable all the time, but they seem to get along. My hypothesis is that intimacy should be the norm, that one ought to be open, and therefore the transactions between people could get things done much faster. People could not worry so much about what they said because what they said was what happened. So I think that we all, and this is just my own opinion, that we all need a very deep level of intimacy. I'm not sure that our social structure could handle it. All our structure is to play games with each other. Byrne talks about this a lot, and games people play. And I think so much of our conversation is made up of understood ways of relating that if someone got open and simply responded to the thing that was apparent in the conversation, it would be too heavy for the world to take. I think we need a radical reorganization of our whole psychological and social worlds to have this level of intimacy be common. Another question was, are you saying that man's quest for intimacy is the most basic human need, more basic than success, say even meaning? Does intimacy give meaning? These are all parts of the same question. I think that the way I'm now seeing intimacy, this longing for relatedness at a personal level with another human being, with another person, may be one of the most basic human needs, not counting the needs for food and the sex drive as such. I think that it is as basic as the need for success, and I think the need for success often supplants it. I think we repress the need for intimacy because it's too threatening, and we perform and get success as a substitute for intimacy. I think in America this may be one of the major things we've done that's kind of criminal to our children, is that we've put a standard of, if you will succeed to the child in doing things the way we think they ought to be done and in getting grades or money or whatever, then we will love you. And so a person who has all the success of a Hollywood star or some great performer or artist or business person seems to have love. And the tragedy is that this then makes intimacy more difficult all the time because there's more to hide. And the more we build up in front, the more frightening it is to reveal how small the one behind is, like the Wizard of Oz. You know, the man, don't look behind that curtain, is what we're all saying, it seems to me, while billowing smoke and great performance out there. So I think that once one has genuine intimacy, he doesn't need as much success. And I would say that is definitely true, for me at least. And as far as intimacy giving meaning, I think that intimate relationships are the stage on which meaning develops. I think meaning is, for most of us, relational. I mean, we have to share it. I don't think one has meaning by himself. One has meaning and immediately wants to share it, to verify it. And until your meaning is verified with another person, somehow it's always suspect to you. And so I think that intimacy allows meaning to be enriched, but I don't think intimacy itself is meaning as such. I think it's more a milieu in which meaning can develop. Okay, there's another question, and this is the last one I'll deal with now because I would like to go on into the other questions, mostly relate to the anatomy of intimacy and to the relationship with God. But this question, is it really possible to be intimate with more than one person at a time? I think it is. And I think certainly intimacy is sometimes between two men, sometimes between two women. Obviously, this question would relate, and that may be my own bias, but would relate to intimacy between a man and woman. And this is the most complex kind because sex is more generally in this one than the other two kinds. And sex complicates intimacy immediately. But I hear the question to mean, is it possible, say, for someone who is either married or committed to one person in an intimate relationship to have a legitimate second relationship of intimacy? And I'd say it's possible, but very tricky, because the nature of intimacy is a kind of safety and exclusiveness of person. If I'm going to be intimate with somebody, I want to know that they're not being intimate with somebody else, because I'm sharing the deepest things I have, and they might, letting somebody else in that same psychological room, they may show them some things that I've hung on the wall in there, which would reveal me and embarrass me. And it's hard enough to do this with one person. Another thing that makes this difficult between men and women is that I see intimacy as the prelude for which sexual intercourse is the sacrament. Intimacy is the intimate sharing of two people. It seems to me that we are physically made so that we want to join each other. We want to be a part of another's life. We say, I want to eat them up. I want to be inside them. I want to be a part of them. And when we are very close with people, there's a longing to consummate this closeness. Well, can you imagine inventing, this is a good kind of a way to believe in creation, because can you imagine inventing a way that two people could be more inside each other, a part of each other, than sexual intercourse? It seems to me that at its best, that sexual intercourse is the natural fulfillment and sacramental expression of the closeness that I'm about to describe in the rest of these remarks. And that what we've done so often in America and in the church is to, when we say they were intimate, we've made intimacy mean sexual intercourse. And that this is a really a bastardizing of the word, because we do not have the closeness, which is very threatening, but we can have sex. And ironically, sex is less threatening than the revealing of oneself. So many marriages and many commitments among people, we use the sex because we're afraid of the more threatening thing of intimacy. And I think, therefore, genuine intimacy often leads to sex. And that's why it would be difficult to have it with two people, is that if you say, I'm married to one woman and I'm going to have a warm, intimate relationship with another one, you're dealing with the most powerful urges in the world, because you're opening doors which lead directly to the centers of one's psyche, which trigger sexual feelings. And so I think you're just asking to fight the strongest urges in the world by trying to have more than one intimate relationship. As a Christian, one would say you're treading on very dangerous ground. Okay, the last question, which I'll kind of use to move into talking about intimacy itself, is what is a definition of intimacy? Many people said, what do you mean when you say intimacy? Well, the dictionary gives several definitions, interestingly enough, none of which in the dictionary I used had to do with sex. But intimate means belonging to or characterizing one's deepest nature, or two, marked by very close association, contact, or familiarity, or three, marked by a warm friendship developed through long association, suggesting informal warmth or privacy of a very personal or private nature. Now, the psychological literature and other kinds of things I could find on intimacy seem to indicate that intimacy is relating closely in a very personal way without manipulation or games. In other words, absolutely saying and doing what one really means about one's private as well as one's public thoughts and feelings in speaking and relating to another human being to whom one is strongly attracted. In other words, it's relating closely without trying to change the situation, just facing the situation and being straight out as one is. Now, as these definitions suggest, intimacy takes place in the deepest, warmest, and most private area of human experience. It's a very exciting and exotic jungle into which one must go, it seems, to discover the sources and shape of his own masculinity, femininity, his own personhood, the shape of friendship and the limits of it, what it means to belong to another, what commitment means, and somewhere hidden in the threatening undergrowth of these kinds of thoughts and feelings, which are so loaded for us, is the mystery of sex, and also, paradoxically, the mystery of a close relationship to God. Now, how does an intimate relationship begin between two people? And is intimacy the same thing as friendship, or getting to know each other to feeling level? I had a real problem in how to even talk to you about this, because most of the things I read were cold abstractions dealing with this warm, moist concept. And anyone's a writer sees that there are dry concepts and moist concepts. Poets know this. And if one doesn't deal with a thing in the mode in which it exists, then it gets boring. So what I'd like to do is to try to deal somehow from an experiential point, to try to taste and smell intimacy as we're talking about it. And how does one talk about it? After I wrote this book and people began to ask me and call about intimacy, I began to interview people and began to read. And let me just think out loud with you about some of the ways an intimate relationship can begin and develop. I'm going to use as a model the relationship between a man and a woman. It's the most complex kind, and I think anything less than that, a lot of these characteristics would apply. And because the subject is so hard to talk about, I'll speak to you as if I were in a relationship being discussed. Now, if you're a man, just imagine you're hearing this from a woman. The first question about this is, how does an intimate relationship begin? People have said to me, can you just tell someone you want to be intimate? Well, good luck if you do that. I'd say no. It's so frightening that it would run me away. But let's just give a kind of an easy beginning that, say, two people are introduced socially at a party. We'd probably begin at a surface level by exchanging certain public information, like what's your name, where do you work, and perhaps where we live. But if we feel drawn to each other, through the sounds of our voices, through the ways we look, our styles of communicating, then the conversation may move imperceptibly into a deeper level. We may begin to talk about what we enjoy doing or reading or listening to. And either some mutual interest will be sparked or a fascination by one or both of us for the other in terms of the way we handle the subjects of interest. This may develop a quickening a kind of feeling, hey, I'd really like to get to know this person. In other words, it quits being just a handshake and a how are you, and you move into a relationship of investigating the other person. And at this point, we may both experience a warm feeling of being pleasantly engaged with each other. A feeling of wanting to be closer, either emotionally or physically, or both, may develop. And with these feelings comes a heightened sense of awareness. I start really noticing what she looks like. Maybe noting some attractive qualities about her person or her clothes that I hadn't noticed when we first met. I might drop in some little personal comments at this point, somewhere in this. And, of course, I'm giving you a model which is not the way it always happens, but it's a way to look at the way it might happen in some cases. Personal comments like, hey, my mother used to love to do that too, referring to something maybe she's mentioned about a childhood home, for instance. And then there's a new level. We have a common history, some things that nobody's talked about to us, and this creates a real warmth. We may begin to notice each other's eyes and wonder what's behind those eyes. There's a quickening of interest, and it's as if the two of us had stepped out of the crowd into an emotional glass bubble where we can only see and hear each other. We have the feeling of being the only two people of any importance in whatever social world we're in at the moment. All else seems trivial in background, and we can only see and hear each other. And many people can be in an enormously noisy place and have this happen. And when a relationship reaches this threshold of intimacy, some things begin to happen which are like magic and feel like magic to the people to whom they're happening. You may find yourself expressing thoughts or feelings which you would normally never reveal because as a child you might have been rejected for them. For instance, you might blurt out, I'm having a lousy time at this party. And I might laugh and say, so am I, but I didn't dare say so. And that sounds like a little thing, but we have shared something that is now present about feelings that could get us rejected. Or I might say something deeper like, I've always been very shy at parties, and I learned to talk and joke a lot to cover up. And this is true, but it's kind of threatening. And you might say, hey, me too. Or you might nod and let me know you understand. And then we share a secret about my pilgrimage and about my life and how I relate to people. And I'm kind of unconsciously telling you some things when I'd get into that kind of revealing of a real feeling. Now, this kind of exchange breeds a new sort of trust in the relationship, and the freedom to express one's true feelings grows. It may just pop open at that point somewhere when somebody does something like this. And it seems amazing to both parties. And many young people have been criticized or put down at home or not been taken seriously. It doesn't have to be young people. It can be often people commit adultery on this basis, that they're put down by a wife or a husband at home, and everything they say is discounted. And suddenly here is somebody who listens and really hears what they're saying. And at this point, you may feel as if you could tell each other anything and still be accepted. Now, it may take days or weeks or even months before two people reach this stage of intimacy, but often it's much sooner. And it kind of sneaks up on people in our kind of society because we're sort of fragmented anyway, and often it happens with strangers faster than it does with people you've known because it's safer somehow. You may not see them again. So people find they're having intimate encounters, brief encounters with people they hardly know. And many young people get engaged or even married on the strength of one brief experience of this sort of beginning intimacy. It is so heady and so different from what they've had. But this is only the threshold of intimacy, the entry hall of any kind of lasting intimacy. And the tragedy is people don't know this, and so they have this experience and they think, aha, this is true love, because it feels like love. All of the storybook things happen, and almost any two people may have this experience and call it true love or profound friendship. But what has happened, it seems to me, is that we've started out with a relative reserve and a feeling that, well, if she doesn't accept me, it doesn't really matter. It'll just be one more rejection. But then it begins to matter when intimacy really starts happening. And when it does matter, then I begin to expect this acceptance. It's as if I know it's going to happen, which gives me an enormous freedom. I know ahead of time that this person is going to accept me. And there's something about the human psyche that's almost a trick that takes place at this point often. And it's a part of the wonder and the deception of this stage of intimacy. There's a kind of selective blindness which enters the relationship. Habits which have always seemed obnoxious in other people seem to be almost attractive in the loved one's behavior. Let's say that I talk too much, which is true, and that's always been a very irritating trait to you and people around you. But somehow my conversation may even seem interesting, and the sound of my voice soothing or stimulating. And you laugh at yourself and say, at the miraculous change that's taken place in your reaction. But of course, this is just a way of putting aside anything that might interfere with this magic that's taken place in your life, this acceptance. We repress it, it seems. Because of the trust and the growing security that we will not be rejected for being ourselves, humor is a more natural and spontaneous thing, since I can risk making a fool out of myself with some assurance of being accepted. And this is the very essence of a good situation for humor. So it seems funny, and I'm attractive in ways I may not have laughed for years, but I can laugh and be myself with you, and you laugh, because situation humor arises out of this kind of situation. Now, another almost wonderful change, which may take place in one or both of us, is a marked sensitivity to the other's pain or anxiety or frustrations. Scales seem to drop off of otherwise insensitive eyes, and the other's needs are seen so that the strong desire to help and comfort each other, which most of us feel, a need to have a part in someone else's healing and love, this can be lived out in this relationship. And often people begin to help each other almost at once, and it's on this helping relationship that intimacy often grows and the other things develop that I've suggested. But when one of us makes a mistake and hurts the other, because I say I make a mistake and hurt you in an intimate relationship, because I feel accepted by you in advance, then it's easier than usual for me to admit I've been wrong and to try to make things right, because it's the fear of not being accepted which keeps me from admitting I'm wrong. So this makes me so magnanimous in an intimate relationship that I think, golly, this woman's changed my life. And in fact, for the time, she has. But it has to do with this security, which can change, as I'll mention. But generally, both of us are amazed at how well we feel understood in some important area or areas. And it's this need to be understood that makes us search the world over for someone to accept us just as we are. This is the religious search as well as the human search. and in ways which there are misunderstandings between us, where we don't understand each other, is another one of these kind of tricky things that happens. We're confident that, that it all can be worked out later. I do a lot of marriage counseling, and young people are sure that old George will change, you know, and old George may not change, but at the time, one is sure that he will. Now, if this is a love relationship between a man and a woman, then a part of the thing which makes these cover-up tactics work, that makes us rationalize, is that there's a strong sense of desire to touch the other person. There's a desire just to touch their skin, to hold and to love them, may come to both people. And, of course, this desire being tied to the strongest urges there are sends an atmosphere of like a perfume over the whole thing, and it makes it difficult to scent the problems in the relationship. And life looks beautiful, just to sort of summarize this stage of intimacy. Life looks beautiful and amazingly simple as compared to the complexity one's known in other relationships. And both of us may feel sorry for the rest of the world. Why can't everyone have intimacy like this and tell people what they're really like the way we can? One of the delightful habits, by the way, of couples experiencing intimacy is that of remembering and retelling the way they met. And the initial feelings about each other in those first glorious hours or days. For a long time, this retelling and retelling may bring back the first magic, and couples may laugh and enter again the glow of love and acceptance that drew them first together. And a feeling of comfort settles in that this close relating, for which we've been waiting a lifetime, will continue unbroken forever. What's happened to these people that have entered this intimate relationship? Well, it seems that what keeps people from risking telling another what they're really like is the early experience of doing just that and having one's real feelings rejected or discounted, as I suggested earlier, as not being acceptable, or maybe having someone laugh at the things we tell and we're mortified by the fact that they told and someone laughed. So very early in life, many of us may withdraw within. And we're not going to let anyone into the inner citadel of our souls, where we really hurt and where we really hope. But miracle of miracles, here at last has come someone who hears bits of our real feelings as we hold them up, and thoughts, and seems to like what they hear, to approve and even have similar thoughts and feelings. We found our defensive walls crumbling, and in our excitement, we often daringly confess and reveal things we never told anyone. We can hear better because we hear the echo of our own experiences against the sounding board of the other one's inner life when the shutters are open. And we feel free. A great sense of freedom comes in this, that we can be ourselves, which is the goal of self-actualization. But then comes a sudden shock. I may realize that I really care for you, care a great deal more than I'd planned. And suddenly your approval and love begin to mean so much that I start hesitating before being honest about my feelings that might not be acceptable to you. This can happen after a marriage, or can happen when one realizes he's going to be in a commitment. And suddenly maintaining the relationship is so important that it becomes more important than being honest. And the fear of losing it changes something, and we don't know what's happened to us. And that hiding behavior begins, which can be the deterioration and the destruction of intimacy almost faster than anything else, and we don't even know it's happened to us. As long as there was no commitment, we were both free to risk being ourselves, so the magic of open acceptance of our real person was possible. But the minute I care more about maintaining peace in the relationship than being myself, and I start hiding feelings and insights which might threaten you and thus destroy the relationship, then paradoxically the real troubles begin. Now, I'm not saying that I believe you should not have an unexpressed thought. I think that would be neurotic and could hurt the other person desperately if you just expressed every thought you had. But ideally, if we were both committed to being open, then hiding destroys more than it protects in the long run. That if we're both committed to being open, then hiding destroys more than it protects. Now, this is one reason people are amazed about the change after marriage or after the honeymoon period. People have fallen in love and had a genuine time of intimacy. And then, when it got terribly important in the engagement period, one started hiding negative feelings about the other. And after the marriage or the honeymoon, and both parties feel a kind of structural security in the marriage, it's not going to blow because we're married now, nobody's going to run away, we've kind of done away with that option, then the real feelings come out and the other party feels betrayed or tricked in a horrible way. And many marriages start cratering at that point and never recover. This year I heard of a man who said he found the perfect woman 4 years ago. He said they could share everything. He had that light, that glassy-eyed look, you know, that he was recalling. He had said they loved to camp, and for 2 years during their courtship, they went camping almost every weekend. She loved it. She told him she loved it. Then they got married, and the groom was looking very sad when he told me this. That was 2 years ago, he said, and we haven't been camping since. It's amazing. The marriage ceremony completely wiped out her love of camping. Now, you can imagine what this would do to an intimate relationship of trust. Now it can become a power game. Are you going to tell me? Am I going to tell you? And it flips over and is the opposite of intimacy. And people have said we have such an intimate relationship that they begin to have the facade of intimacy to the world, and they never tell anyone that they lost it the minute they committed to each other. Okay, now what are some of the problems which arise in an intimate relationship after it's established, and what can be done to keep them from destroying intimacy? Because I think that marriage counseling, I think that choosing a mate, I think choosing someone to be deeply committed to, these all have to do with these sorts of things. And I couldn't find much on it, so I'm going to give you some things just describing places where the relationship gets to that are liable to be sticky. First thing is, when the closeness described becomes very intense, we may find ourselves wanting to be together all the time. It's very natural to do this. We find ourselves calling, writing notes, always together every free moment. But sooner or later, one or the other of us may feel that our freedom and identity as a person are threatened. It's as if there were a cage being built around our life by the other, and the urge rises to run away, and it's almost overpowering to get out of there, even though one is still in love. It's very hard to understand this paradox. And the only way I've found to deal with this is to confess the feelings, even though the risk of your thinking you're being rejected is very frightening. But I can say something like, I have a problem. My identity and sense of freedom are so fragile that I need to tell you that I get scared to death when I feel I can never do things on my own, which I need to get done. And since intimacy usually thrives when there is some space for a man to be with the boys, for instance, and for a woman to be with the girls, that is to have each one to have identity things he does without the other, then this is a necessary thing to get straight between the parties if the intimacy is going to have a long life. In fact, when two people do not want to be with anyone else, their relation may be an addiction instead of intimacy. They look very much alike. There's a new book, or it's about a year or so old, I guess, called Love and Addiction, which I'd recommend to you if you think maybe this is a problem for you. Because the traits of addiction are that one must have a constant source of the meeting. It's meeting one's intimate problems from the outside. I bring dope in to meet the intimate problems of security and loneliness. Well, if you can bring a person in the same way and to force them to meet these needs, and what happens with an addiction is you need more and more of the addictive substance, need more and more of the person until you will not let them out. But paradoxically, the satisfactions are less and less, so that you're clinging to each other and can't let anybody else in the relationship, but in a sense you've destroyed the very thing that you hope to get by the addictive person or substance. And I believe that each person must maintain his individual identity for real intimacy to continue. And this is scary because one wants to have a total commitment for the other person. So it's a balanced thing that you've got to discuss, I think. One has to discuss. But if a couple does not face these needs for independent identity, then the fears of losing one's freedom can cause the fearful party to do something to bring about the breakup of the intimate relation. And strangely, this is usually something unrelated to the real problem, leaving both parties bewildered and hurt. Now, as a matter of fact, this seems to be a characteristic pattern concerning the breaking up of an intimate relationship. That is that the people often cause the breakup rather than face the real fears or difficulties in their own life, many of which could be solved and faced. Well, now someone asked me when I read this to him, what do you mean unrelated to the real problem? Well, for instance, let's say that one party wants more freedom, but doesn't want to face that fact because it might look like a rejection to the other party. So instead of facing the fact that what I really want is more freedom, I may begin to pick at my loved one about being late or being messy, picking a fight to destroy the relationship over those little things when in fact I'm afraid to face the fact that I really want my freedom. Whereas if I would face the fact with that person, it might be threatening to them, but just by facing it, the pressure would be gone, and we could talk it out, and maybe I could have some of that freedom. Because often the other person wants it too. And both parties break up the relationship because of the paradoxical fear that they'll be trapped and subsumed into somebody else's life. Another common problem is jealousy and the fear of being deserted. And this can cause endless haggling, accusations, and exquisite pain. The only successful way I've found to deal with this is for both parties to discuss what their commitment to each other includes when they get to the place where a commitment's going to be made. In other words, if it's a dating relationship, is this dating relationship exclusive? If not, or if a marriage is contemplated, under what conditions can each tolerate the other seeing people of the opposite sex? Genuine intimate relationship seems to almost call for an exclusive or at least a clearly number one priority to that relationship because of the deeply vulnerable position a person's in who is sharing his or her deepest hopes and dreams in a committed way. But let's say that I'm jealous, and you have two courses, basically, you can follow. Either you can deny any cause for jealousy and call me unreasonable, which will just drive me up the wall, or you can understand the irrational nature of jealousy and how it's tied to my basic security as a man, and help me by not inciting jealousy through flirting behaviors and not being secretive and not hinting subtly or openly that how men find you attractive all the time and tell hero stories when we meet. Now, in writing Please Love Me and in talking to Hetty, I realize how subtle this problem is and how strong the need in many of us is to get attention and affirmation from the opposite sex. And the worst thing is that the signals I or you may send out to other people are largely unconscious. I've counseled with many people whose conscious intention is to be totally faithful to their husbands or wives or to their principals, only to be horrified when someone makes passes at them or even tries to seduce them or, in the case of women, rape them. I've tried to explain that this can be the result of an unconscious psychological game, which is very common. And these people almost always deny the possibility that they could be playing such a game and ask me to describe what a game is. I tell them that a game, in Eric Burns' usage, is a way of avoiding true, honest intimacy and yet still maintaining close contact with another person. It's a way of hooking them to you, grappling them to you without being honest. So you have the feeling of closeness, which is the next thing to intimacy, without intimacy itself. But both parties wind up getting hurt in a psychological game. Now, for instance, the game I'm describing might go something like this. A fine Christian woman, I'll use a woman, just it could be either a man or a woman, but a fine Christian woman may have as her conscious intention only having casual and social relations, including dinners, movies, and talking to the men around her. But she finds that contrary to her wishes, the men she is with practically turn into animals, she says. She, of course, stiff-arms them in horror, and the men are embarrassed and frustrated, and both parties wind up being hurt and bewildered. But what has happened in many cases is something like this. Although the woman's conscious intention is not to seduce the man, in fact, she unconsciously gives him encouraging glances or laughs and kids in such a way that he feels increasingly that she wants him to come closer and closer. And finally, when he feels her encouragement is very real, he moves in physically or tries to. But since the woman is not conscious that she sent any come-hither signals, she's surprised and offended at his approach. Women who deny any such unconscious flirting and encouragement often don't understand that the average man is every bit as afraid of rejection as they are, and he will not risk making an ass out of himself. So if he is sensitive at all, he must see some signs of encouragement before he moves towards sexual intimacy. But if a man or a woman, because evidently just as common in both sexes, is not aware that he is sending out signals, then he may have a lot of trouble helping his intimate partner with problems of jealousy. After all, he may reason, women are attracted to him. Can he help it? Of course, the real answer is yes, he can, by not playing games. But the tragedy is that many intimate relationships are destroyed by jealousy and those kinds of games. And what's the solution? Well, one is the awareness that you're playing him. And this is somehow, it's very hard to face because we're cutting off the source of some real affirmation that we almost have to have in many cases. Now, another pitfall in intimate relations is the problem is one's feelings getting so deep that the thought of the beloved's leaving or walking away would be almost intolerable. If I find myself in this position, I may start picking at you irrationally by being bossy or perfectionist about trivial things or bringing up your past intimate relations or mine. This is very baffling and irritating to you, and you may become very angry and hurt and bewildered. But what's often happening is that the one who's afraid the other may leave is, as I've already suggested, actually and perhaps unconsciously sabotaging the relationship. It's better to cause the breakup myself than to be deserted. We feel at some level unworthy, so we'd rather destroy a beautiful relationship ourselves than to risk loving very deeply and being deserted or betrayed. And my fear, and in my fear, my ears change, and this is a great tragedy, and I may begin to hear what I'm afraid of, which may not be there at all. I begin to hear the echo of my own self-rejection, and I may cause the thing I fear to happen. I may drive you away through my fear of it, and you won't know what happened either. Now, the only solution I know for this is for me, if I'm the fearful party, to be able to honestly express my fears and for you to be able to identify when possible. Or at least admit that you're sometimes tempted to sabotage our relationship too, rather than face the truth about your fears and insecurities. Often just the facing of the truth can take enough pressure off to keep the sabotage from happening and to bring us back together at a new depth. And this facing together of the scary stuff in our relationship seems to be what makes intimacy grow more deep and strong. And it's a paradox because we resist the very thing that makes it grow, this confronting of ourselves. Another problem is when the relationship begins to have overtones of demanding a total commitment. Either the trap feeling I discussed earlier may come, or the fear of not being able to live up to the commitment. And this is a very real thing. I may feel that, gosh, it's wonderful, we are together, and we're happy, and we're honest and open, and then suddenly we start moving toward a deep, total commitment. And suddenly I realize, gosh, if you really knew me, you wouldn't love me. It's all right now. I don't think I could maintain this kind of honesty. I don't think I could keep being this free. And I'd rather not have you see that so much. Because then if you walked away, what would I do? I would have showed you everything, and you would have left me. So this causes a panic to take place sometimes. Either one of these feelings can cause one, again, to begin sabotaging the intimacy. There are a lot of things I could talk about. Because of the time, I'll just summarize some of the things which appear to me to be almost essential in maintaining an intimate relationship. One thing, I think, again and again in these problems, bringing up hostile, fearful, and even loving feelings, bringing them out in the open and expressing them, and then classifying them in the sense of realizing how many come from my own fears rather than your bad intentions. I think at this point, my confessing these fears is so threatening, but I don't know of any other way to get them out in the open. And this seems like it would destroy things for you to be this honest with me, or me to be this honest. But strangely, there's a great relief when I know the truth. It's the mystery of what you might be thinking that causes me to do my real worrying. And then, after we've discussed these things, then we put the feelings aside. Now, making sure that the other party has a chance to recover from his reactions to the revealed feelings. For instance, at one point in a relationship, I was jealous of a certain man. And the woman began to think about this. And suddenly she realized she had real strong feelings for him. And I panicked. The thing to have done in the normal kind of relationship, oh, no, I don't have these strong. But this person was very honest and said, yeah, I really do have these feelings. And if she'd just moved on, she felt very relieved because she wasn't going to do anything about them. And she said that she cared more for me. But man, had she just left, I'd have been panicky. But the thing is that then I had to work through my reaction to her honesty. And within a very short period of time, it was all right. Because I realized that I have people that I could be attracted to and am. But I'm not going to do anything about that either, and that's a very human thing. And I wasn't allowing her humanity space. But once I allowed it, then I was able to face not only her situation, but my own in relating to other people. Second thing is that to communicate about how things are going when there's no crisis. In other words, sometimes just say, hey, I'm really glad to know you, when there's nothing wrong. And again, to say why. I really think you have a neat mind, or a neat body, or I like the way you laugh. to communicate about how things are going and what someone means to you when there isn't a crisis. Another thing is that to realize, and this is so important, that intimacy is always an ebb and flow matter, and not to panic if all the romantic feelings are not receiving high-voltage expression. Sometimes things are plain vanilla in an intimate relationship, and it's almost that there must be a gathering, a slow gathering of emotion in order to express it. It's like gathering a bouquet of individual flowers that don't seem very important, and then you present them to the person. This is the sexual rhythm. I think it's also the emotional rhythm of it doesn't seem very exciting till you put it together, and then suddenly you have the feelings. You'll feel lost. It's normal to have these vanilla feelings. You'll feel lost and want to run away and say, we've lost it. And that may cause something to happen. But to realize that it's normal to want to run away, too. And it would be great to be able to express this strong urge to run to safety, realizing it'll probably threaten the stew out of the other party, but it also may free her to express her own feelings of wanting to run away. And then once you've expressed that, there's no need to, in many cases. Fourth, there, to leave space for each other. I saw an article in my reading about two circles overlapping, and the part that is overlapping is the intimacy. And sometimes in a loving time, the circles can almost totally overlap when you're together and no one's around. And at other times, they barely seem to be touching, and there's space that is separate for each of us. And somehow to learn that this is a natural thing, that it can't just, you can't just lock the circles over each other. You must leave space for each other to have individual time apart. And fifth, to learn to adjust to each other's timing. To learn to adjust when to talk and when to be still. To learn the rhythm of sex, if that's appropriate in the relationship. To learn when to play and when to be serious. And you can't memorize these things. It just is a point of watching and listening to the person. Intimacy is characterized by a real spontaneity. You can't memorize ways to love someone. They will not work. That will work in sex. But in intimacy, you may have to love them one time. They're affected by something. And if they're really being free the next time, they may be affected by something else. So you must continually come with the threat of failure, even in sex or in anything else, and because you have to listen and watch and hear each other and where the other person is. This is true of when to read, when to separate and go away, when I can walk alone. Sixth, since the main block to intimacy, and this is the final thing, the main block to intimacy and the cause of its dissolution appears to be so often the fear of betrayal, rejection, and possibly desertion. It seems to me that it's almost impossible to establish and maintain over a period of time a genuine, game-free, intimate relationship unless one has a basic security beyond love and approval of the loved one. In other words, unless if the relationship failed, you have some place to go, then you will not be able to risk being free in the relationship. And in my own experience, this security is a personal relationship to God as is revealed in Christ. If my loved one rejects me or betrays me, I may be devastated, and I will be. But the relation to God and His people will be there to build new relationships in and to be healed in. And this basic security can sometimes allow me to risk rejection by facing the real issue in my relationships. At least this is my hope. And since I've failed to do this so many times in the past few years, I'm particularly grateful to have gotten some awareness through the writing of Please Love Me and through the research that I've done, some awareness of some of the self-defeating behaviors I and the people around me have used, which have bruised or broken some of the most important relationships in my life. Without believing in God and His continuing love and acceptance of me, I don't think I'd ever risk close relationships again. Again and again, as I wrestled with a picture of the anatomy of intimacy, of an intimate relationship between persons, I asked myself, what does this have to do with one's relationship to God? And that's the third and last thing I'd like to talk to you about. One of the questions which has come up most often about this book is that, is this a Christian approach? Is it Christian to be intimate? Is this open and extremely personal kind of relating really Christian? Yes, I believe it is. And that this, in fact, is one of the key things which is often missed about the gospel. As I looked through the gospels after writing this book, I saw how often Jesus had very intimate conversations with people. Look at the woman at the well in John 4. She was a Samaritan, a foreigner. It would be like being of another race to us in this country some years back. She was a free liver, and she was a woman. And at that time, rabbis couldn't even talk to a woman in public, even their own wife or daughter or sister. And yet Jesus not only talked to her, but as I kind of listened in on the conversation, he talked to her about her most intimate life, her sex life, her divorces, and her personal faith. And I began to ask myself, is this just an isolated case? But I went back through the New Testament, and it's a pattern, it seems to me, in Jesus' ministry. He often dove to an intimate relationship in the midst of a religious discussion, and it invariably changed the conversation from religious bickering to a personal encounter with the reality of an individual's life. Look at the story of the rich young ruler. He came with a legal question about what was the law of God, and Jesus looked at him and listened to him, and then he went straight under and said, "Your problem is the love of money." And it crashed into the personal security level of the man's life. Or the woman caught in the act of adultery. The men came to him with a legal question, and he looked at them, and he took the question back to the inner lives of the men condemning her. What is your own experience with adultery? It was a very intimate thing to do. And it was a high-risk venture, too, because this was not the way rabbis behaved. It seems that the basic problem God had to deal with in the Bible is separation. The separation between persons and between one's person and God's person. Also between what we are and what we present to the world. The hypocrisy. These are things God abhorred in the Hebrew people. Now, this separation is called sin. The separation between a person and God. And it keeps us from intimacy. And it permeates each of our experience and has to do with the way we're made and develop. In other words, the basic separation that's talked about in the Bible is the separation we feel that I talked about earlier that keeps us from being intimate with another human being. So I'm saying that sin, in the Christian sense, is the thing that separates us from intimacy. Now, Paul Tournier talks about the way we develop, and I'd like to give you a brief picture kind of the anatomy of the person so that we can look at what it means to be a person in relationship to God. Paul Tournier, the Swiss psychiatrist, talks about the child being born as a natural being and that he reacts to things as they happen to him in a natural way, but he must have love and approval. So what happens very early on is that the mother says, "No, no," when he does something natural. And so he starts watching the mother because she's withdrawing her love and approval. So he begins to shape his behavior so that he gains love and approval, which he has to have. So his real person is locked inside, and he develops things that look like masks, or as Tournier calls them, personages. He develops a personage to please his mother, another personage to please his teacher. And he begins to withdraw inside. So that we shape our lives this way, to please our parents often, or the people who raise us. I know we have one of our daughters, we moved into a house when our children were little, and this was a new house, and we couldn't really afford it, and we got in, we spent everything we had and more, and we sat down in the kitchen just exhausted, and when the movers left, and this middle child saw this beautiful 30-foot white hall down the middle of this house. And she got out her royal blue finger paints and did a mural down the whole hall. Now, this is the only child in our family who's not interested in art. What happened was the reaction was so strong that she realized she was not going to get love and approval by that behavior, and she might have been a fine artist. Now, this happened to me in my own life. I always wanted to be a writer and a communicator, but my father was in the oil business, and he loved my brother more. My brother was a big athlete, and so what I did is I repressed my desire to be a writer and hid this as a shameful thing. My father would have thought anybody who was a writer was effeminate. And that was the last thing I could tolerate, not having his love. And so I got in the oil business and tried to do the masculine thing and buried the part of me that was the real person. Now, what happens and the way it happens is something like this in Tournier's view, that a little child doesn't keep any secrets at first. He thinks his mother knows everything. And so he doesn't think about hiding from her. But let's say that it's time for him to go to nursery school. So she takes him down the street by the park, and they go across where the policeman is, and they go to school, and they walk home by way of the stores across from the park, and they come home where the other policeman is. And after he's done this enough times that she knows he can make it, then she lets him go on his own. It's a big day when he goes on his own. He feels like he's John Wayne going to work and hopes somebody will see him walking by himself. And he goes off to school, and he comes home, and his mother says, "Sit down, son. How'd you go to school?" He says, by way of the park. How'd you come home? By way of the stores. What'd the teacher say? Questions, questions, questions. And this happens to him every day. Pretty soon he gets a belly full of this. And he says, in rebellion, he thinks that the world will fall in because she knows all this stuff. Why is she asking him? So he does something he's never done before. He lies. And she says, how'd you go to school? Well, he went to school by way of the park. He says, by way of the park. How'd you come home? He came back by way of the park. He says, by way of the stores. And he cringes. And she says, what'd the teacher say? All of a sudden, he realizes an amazing fact. His mother does not know everything. Look at the possibility this opens to him. The fact that he can have a private life. So the first movement toward being a whole person is to be able to keep a secret. The child realizes he can have a private life that's just his own, that even his mother can't get into, or his father. And so the first movement toward being a whole person capable of genuine intimacy is to be able to keep a secret. But if one can only keep a secret, he can be an individual, but he can't relate intimately or be a whole person. Because the second movement is to choose to tell someone one's secrets. And this is the first free act of intimacy. Now, not that one must tell to be a whole person, but one must be free to choose to tell. To be whole is to be able to choose intimacy. Okay? But we don't tell each other because we're afraid to. Now, what's happened? We tried and we were rejected to be who we were. So we develop these personages, like a series of masks, which we partly reveal ourselves and partly hide from people and from God, and finally from ourselves, because we hate ourselves for not being what we think we could be. We won't even try anymore, and pretty soon we don't even know who we are. And this separation between what we present to the world and who we really are inside, when it gets to be a certain distance, is called mental illness. And there's no intimacy possible at that stage. When we cannot even know ourselves, we cannot share ourselves with anyone. So we go to a psychiatrist, a counselor, and we enter a relationship with him which is structured intimacy. We begin to tell him who we are very tentatively. We're afraid that he'll reject us, but we're so desperate and so much in pain because this separation is very painful between who we are and who we present to the world. So we begin to tell him who we are. And at one point he may say, as Tournier says, I may say, I hate my 16-year-old son. And then we look to see if he's going to reject us terribly. And the psychiatrist may say, 16? Wait till he's 17. You'll want to kill him. And we say, what? We look at him, you're coping with this? And you're a normal person? And suddenly, we enter a whole different phase. It's not the personage of a psychiatrist talking to the personage of a little patient. Suddenly, we're two persons. We come out from the inside and share the person journey of being fathers. And healing takes place, begins to take place at that moment. And in the church, there's no place for this among Christians, almost. And it used to be the place where it happened. But even here, the barrier to intimacy is enormous between people because of our need to hide and protect ourselves, which again is our sin. Now, my person, as is Camus or Sartre, who says, each of us is like a person locked in a little black box, tapping on the wall, hoping to God someone out there will hear us. That in a sense, when we develop personage, we get to this isolated place, and we wonder, I wonder what your person is like, but I don't know. But because of my great fear, I can't reveal myself to you, so we talk trivia and avoid intimacy. And thus we become a nation or a church bound inside ourselves, keeping our persons wrapped like mummies in the grave clothes of our parents' needs and projections and our own fears of being known and rejected. Now, if this is true, that our basic separations from persons and thus from true intimacy is our hiding, then how can we let ourselves be known and help other people to take down the barriers with us and with others? Throughout the Bible, throughout the biblical narrative, this was God's first and continuing problem with people, to provide a way we could take down the barriers our hiding or sin had caused, and yet he had to leave us our freedom and privacy. And this is the situation we're confronted with people. We can't crash in on people and be intimate. We must find a way that they can be intimate, give them permission to be intimate, without crashing in on their freedom. The author of Hebrews says that in the past, God spoke in many different ways, visions and dreams and even face-to-face to the nation of Israel, trying to tell us little by little about himself and his plan for human life. And finally, and he couldn't do it, we couldn't hear him. And finally, in Jesus Christ, he ripped open his chest and revealed his person, his hopes and dreams about how men and women could live honestly and openly with each other and before God. Jesus Christ is the person of God, come to have a person dialogue with us. But he can't, because we are hiding behind our personages, behind our barriers. Another way to put this is that Jesus Christ is God's offer of intimacy with us as persons. We long to get inside each other's lives and experience. And the Holy Spirit, Christ said, will come to be inside us. And in Christ, we come to be inside God's experience in a new way. But we're blocked and bound as a people. How can we help each other come out? Well, there's a parable which Bruce Larson has really helped me with, which indicates maybe what we could do for each other to have intimacy in the church and have reality. It's the parable of Lazarus, and I'd never seen this until Bruce pointed it out. And that is that, remember, Jesus came and Lazarus had died, and he was late. And Martha and Mary, Lazarus' sisters, chewed him out about being late. And he said, come on, let's go out to the grave. And they said, all right. So they went out, and he said, roll back the stone. And they said, no, he's been dead 4 days. He'll smell. And so Jesus said, roll back the stone, as the story went. And then he shouted, Lazarus, come out. And you remember that according to the story, Lazarus walked out of the grave. But when he did, he was totally bound, and all he could say was, if anything, hallelujah, with gritted teeth. Now, here he was, Jesus Christ had brought him to life, but he was totally bound and couldn't use the life he had. And Jesus Christ never got him out of those grave clothes. That's the amazing thing. We keep waiting for Christ to change us and give us intimacy. But he said to the people standing around, you unwrap him. And somehow it seems to me that this is our job, to somehow unwrap each other so that we can come out from inside and can be free to relate intimately and can use the creative things we have not just for ourselves but to relate to other people. Now, how did Jesus do this? How did he operate? Look at the woman at the well story. He took the conversation from the world of personages, the world of eating and drinking and law, with these outside barriers that they have which separated him and this woman. He took these barriers of religious, social, and status differences, and he dove to the world of persons behind these personages. The world of loneliness, of divorce, of greed, and sexual difficulties, and the lack of meaning. And in the process, he risked telling the woman who he was in his person, the Messiah. He risked her thinking he was crazy and rejecting him. And in coming out from hiding, there's always a very vulnerable thing to do. And Jesus risked doing it. And this is what God evidently risked in Jesus Christ, coming out and risk the rejection of the people in his world. And he got it. But somehow we were freed to be intimate because of it. And when she felt known and not judged, they entered a person dialogue, and she found the acceptance, the intimacy with Christ, the search for which may have driven her through 5 husbands. Jesus unwrapped her by being intimate himself, and the barriers fell between them. Now, this happened in my life. When I became a Christian, I realized I was in the oil business, and I wanted very much, as I said earlier, to be a communicator, to be a writer. But I was afraid to, for fear I'd be rejected by my father and the people like him, because that wasn't the thing one did in the Southwest, in my society that I grew up in. And a group of Christians said to me, Keith, you're a writer, you're a communicator, you ought to try it. And I said, really? And I didn't believe them, and I was so excited, and somehow they unwrapped me. They listened to me and let me be what I could be. And I began to write, and somehow I began to feel at home with myself, vocationally. Now, I think that there are many of us who are dying to be unwrapped and have hints of what we might be or do as persons, but we can't risk it. How does one begin an intimate relationship with God so that he can find the security, which I'm convinced is the key to lasting intimacy with people and the key to freedom? I think first, if you're in this situation, I think what one does is reveal himself with all his doubts and sins and fears of commitment. I just tell God, God, I'm afraid to commit myself to you. I'm afraid to let you be intimate with me and to be known by you. And then secondly, I would say something like, even though I'm afraid, I would like to commit as much of myself to you as I can, to as much of you as I can grasp, Christ, right now. And I would like to give you permission to teach me about yourself, and to let you lead me into an honest, game-free kind of intimacy with you and with other people. Now, I know that This may sound very strange to some of you, but there's almost no place in the church or in life where one can be still and make this kind of beginning commitment, which is the thing that actually freed me. It's as if a good many of us are dating God. We're looking at Him and thinking about Him, and it's like dating someone. It's very different when one commits into a marriage, and there's a sense in which there's an analogy with God. And I'd just like to suggest that if any of you would like to do this, this is what you would do. Just to say to God that you're afraid of Him, and tell Him who you are. And then the second thing, tell Him that you would like to make a beginning commitment to God and to learn about Him, so that He can free you to be the person you can be potentially. Now, on the outside chance that some of you may want to do this, I'm going to be quiet now so that you can make a beginning or a deeper beginning of an intimate relationship with God. If you'd like to do this, turn off the tape now and simply tell God in your own words your intention. And if you do, then turn the tape player back on and I'll talk to you about what you've done. This sort of commitment that you've made is not a promise to perform or to do anything, but it's a beginning step into a new way of living, which begins in the most intimate part of your experience, where you are right now, and moving into all of one's relationships and purposes in life. I don't know of anyone who's been able to live this way alone very long, so I hope you can get with some other people you'd like to go on this Christian adventure with. Perhaps tell them that you've made a beginning and that you'd like to enter an experiment with them. And there are a lot of things you can do together. Now, if you can't find anyone, or if you can, there are some things you can do by yourself that you can begin today. Now, what I'm going to tell you sounds very simplistic, but I think down inside, I've always been a lot simpler and more of a child than I've been able to admit. So these things have been real to me and have helped me to make this beginning. If you'll just take 7 to 10 minutes a day and do the following things. And this is an easy thing to remember. It's a way to begin praying if you never prayed before. It's a little acrostic, A-C-T-S, the word acts. And each letter is a part of prayer. And I begin by, A is for adoration. I just tell God that I love Him. Sometimes I might read a psalm or just say, I love you, God. The second thing is a confession, and that's to be very specific and honest. I confess that I hurt Joe today, and I didn't mean to, and I cut him because he scared me, and I thought he was going to put me down. I confess that I am full of myself and want to be number one. Things like that that you may have in your life that are things that I have in mind. The next thing is thanksgiving. I just thank God that He takes people like me and loves us and even uses us to help people, and that He has a purpose and meaning that is not just a grim religious thing, but that is a way to live that's fun and is a good growing thing. And I thank Him for all kinds of little things and big things. I know that theologically one might get in trouble with this, but it's the way I feel. And I think it's in the mainstream of Christian tradition. I'm not making a one-on-one correlation with things one prays about and with things that happen, but I'm saying the alchemy of faith is such that when one prays, things begin to happen in a different way in his life. That I know. And then the last thing is supplication, to pray for other people. And I keep a list of people that I pray for, and I don't know what's best for people, but I talk about them to God. And then lastly, I pray for things for myself. And I had a hard time doing this because I thought it was selfish for years. But if being a father, when my children come to me, I want them to tell me what they think they need. A lot of times I can't give it to them, but it helps our relationship. And the intimate thing happens when they share with me their little hopes and dreams that are fragile. And so I share mine with God. Besides this, I will read a passage, say a chapter in the Gospels. This is a help just to begin to permeate one's life with the attitudes and the kinds of experiences that are recorded when the story of the Gospel is being told. And over the years, it's amazing how much insight and truth about the Bible can come into one's life this way. And I'd try to meet once a week with some other people who also want to live their lives in the light of the message and the intimate love of God. I meet with some business people on Tuesday morning at 6:30, and I don't know when you will or if you can find them. I'm just saying it's been a good thing for me, and it kind of saves my bacon when I do it. And lastly, I don't know of any other way toward intimacy and paradoxically toward wholeness. then through a commitment to God of the kind you've made just now, and of the process and the adventure of trying to find His will for living my life. I hope that this will be a good experience for you too.